a plantation to support a college on the island. That college isn't established for, you know, basically another 30, 35 years. But in fact, actually, one of the things one finds is an extraordinary amount of West Indian wealth being funneled into American colleges from this long before the Codrington Grant was established by Christopher Codrington. Harvard was actually in the West Indies seeking both students and donations. You know, when William and Mary is founded in 1693, the Virginia College depends heavily upon the local planters. It's a planter's college. And so it's very much a regional, local school that uses the local slave wealth to sustain itself. Yale is established 8 years later in 1701, and Yale then begins seeking students and donations well beyond Connecticut's borders, often turning toward the West Indies. By the middle of the 18th century, when all the new colleges are established, Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, Columbia, Brown, Rutgers, and Dartmouth, between 1746 and 1769, that 23-year period, six new colleges are established on the mainland, meaning that the number of colleges in mainland North America triples from 3 to 9. That's the height of the African slave trade. And these colleges are now aggressively pursuing the West Indians as sources of both money and students. John Witherspoon at Princeton, the president who comes from Scotland to help save this struggling college in 1768, almost immediately writes a missive to the West Indians in which he declares that the very name of a West Indian has come to imply great opulence. He continues to bow before the Jamaicans and the Barbadians and to present Princeton as the logical place for them to send their sons, because wealthy boys from the West Indies will be preyed upon by unscrupulous people if you send them to England's universities. But if you send them up to Princeton, New Jersey, they'll be well taken care of, they'll be carefully attended to, and they'll be churned into good Christian men and sent back to their families as productive citizens.
You're listening to a one-hour discussion with author and historian Craig S. Wilder. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, more about his brand new book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. I believe every lie that I ever told. Paid for every heart that I ever stole. I played my cards and I didn't fold. Well, it ain't that hard when you got sold. Somewhere I heard that life is a test. I've been through the worst, but I still get my best. God made my mold different from the rest. Then he broke that mold, so I know I'm blessed. Stand up now and face the sun. Won't hide my tail or turn and run. It's time to do what must be done. Be a king when kingdom comes. Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody.
I'm Elliot Gould, and you're listening to Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott.
Welcome back. This is Sojourner Truth. I'm your host, Margaret Prescott. We will now continue our discussion with MIT professor of history and author Craig S. Wilder about his brand new book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. In your book, you don't leave south of the border out of it. I mean, you talk about what happened in places like Peru and other parts of Latin America. And what the Jesuits did, because there is such a relationship also with this kind of religious fervor that you kill the natives and enslave the Africans, right? And with all kinds of justifications.
Yeah, you know, Harvard, the story of Harvard doesn't make sense without the Catholic story. You know, you actually have to, 100 years before Harvard's established, the first college in the Americas is established by Catholic priest in what's now the Dominican Republic. In Santo Domingo. It's the Autonomous University in Santo Domingo. And it's still there. The Dominican Republic to this day has the oldest university in the Americas. It's right there. I'm probably the one person who went to the Dominican Republic and didn't go to the beach. I went to the university. I also went to Barbados and never saw a beach. I went to Codrington College.
It's beautiful.
Hung out on campus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. And wandered around that campus, the entire time. But, 100 years before Harvard in 1536, the Jesuits established a college in Santo Domingo. And the role of the college in Santo Domingo is the conversion of the indigenous population and the supplying of the administrations of this new Spanish empire that's being built in the Americas. In the aftermath of the construction of that school, everywhere that Spain invaded, everywhere that Spain colonized, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, it established universities. And the role of the universities was the conversion of the indigenous population, the codification of indigenous languages, and the universities were sustained by a network of plantations that used enslaved Africans to support the institutions, to generate the wealth that allowed these institutions to carry out their missions. And so the largest slaveholders in Spanish America will actually be the Jesuit priests, the Jesuit order, by the time that they're expelled from the Americas 2 centuries later. And so you have, in fact, from the very beginning of European colonialism in the Americas, this very close tie between the establishment of universities, the conquest of native people, and the use of enslaved African labor to support the missions of the university and the processes of conquest.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder. He has a brand new book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of the Americas. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, Dr. Wilder, another sort of myth that there is around has to do with the numbers of people enslaved in the eastern part of the United States, then the colonies.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to do with the book was you have to break down, as you described it, a lot of the myths that we have about the nature of slavery in colonial America. One of them is this clear distinction that we draw, which is really based upon the later history of the establishment of the United States, between the West Indian colonies and the North American mainland colonies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that myth needs to be shattered. We have to get beyond that or you never understand what happens in New England. You can't understand the history of New England without understanding the history of Barbados and Jamaica. And the same thing is true for the Mid-Atlantic. The history of New York is, in fact, intimately tied to the history of the West Indies. Another myth that we have to break down is a myth about where the geography of slavery itself, in which we tend to imagine that the enslaved population is in the West Indies and the American South. And the relationship between the northern colonies and those places is fairly loose. And the way you break down that myth is really by remembering first that the Atlantic slave trade is largely organized through the northern colonies, that the chief slaving port of the Americas is actually Providence, Rhode Island, that Boston, Philadelphia, New York are all, in fact, competing to enter into that trade and to dominate that trade. And that one of the consequences of this heavy northern involvement in the slave trade is the growth of a population of enslaved black people in the northern colonies themselves, and particularly in the areas surrounding these slave trading ports. And so you find, in fact, in Manhattan, probably, one out of five people at its height is an enslaved African. Mm. In Brooklyn, it's one out of three. And part of the logic of this is actually that Brooklyn, like much of New England, is a largely agricultural society, but much of the agricultural product, the rise of a kind of commercial agriculture, is intended to supply the plantations in the South and in the West Indies. And so there is, in fact, a real use of unfree labor in the northern colonies to help produce the materials that will supply slavery in the southern colonies and the West Indian colonies. And so one of the things I wanted to do in the book was really to show the dramatic rise of the black population in the Americas. And I think it really is easy to forget the sweeping demographic transformation of the Americas that takes place in the centuries after Columbus. I often do this with my students. I think most of my students are ready for the moment because they've taken a lot of United States history and American history, North American history. Most of us are ready for this moment when people of European descent come to outnumber Native Americans. But what they might not be ready for, what we're often not ready for, is the moment when people of African descent come to outnumber Native Americans. And so one of the things I did in the book is I tried to just show the impact of all of this by reminding people that probably as early as, in fact, earlier than 1750, the black population of the 13 seaboard colonies, the 13 colonies that eventually established the United States, before 1750, somewhere before, the black population actually comes to outnumber the entire Native American population east of the Mississippi River. And so one of the ways in which we have to think about the role of the slave trade and the role of slavery in shaping colonial society is that it's funding the constant expansion of the colonies, the constant push into Native American territory, the constant push westward is actually allowed by both the slave trade and the expansion of African slavery. 50 years later, there are likely more black people in the on the Atlantic seaboard of the United States, of the early nation, than there are Native Americans everywhere in what's now the continental United States. You know, these are sweeping demographic transformations, and unless we actually think about them in those terms, you miss a lot about American history.
Our guest is Craig Stephen Walder, Dr. Walder, who is a history professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he has a brand new book out entitled Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. I recall reading not that long ago about this huge slave grave that was found in New York City under what is around Wall Street, and that it was found that a lot of those who were buried there were actually worked to death. They were worked so hard that they literally died from overwork. And one has to keep that level of brutality in mind as well. One of the things that my daughter actually pointed out to me, she says, Mom, you know, I feel as if I was born in another era, that I could have been made into a purse. And that wasn't so far-fetched because it was the use of African skin as hides to make bags, the way that Holocaust victims, that happened to Holocaust victims in Germany, that where skin was used to make lampshades and various other knickknacks.
Right.
And that has to be part of looking at this, the entire thing as well in relation to the universities.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I hope I do in the book is really to break down yet another body of myths about the nature of slavery in the northern states. And so when we admit that we had slavery in the northern colonies and northern states, we then, in fact, had tended to create another myth about it, that it was somehow gentler and milder and sort of fundamentally at its core, more humane than slavery in the South and the West Indies, the other comparison points. And in fact, actually, if one looks at the nature of slavery on campus, the people who were enslaved on college campuses, Eleazar Wheelock, the founder of Dartmouth College, which is founded in 1769, arrives in New Hampshire with 8 enslaved black people, 7 adults and a child. He's got more slaves than faculty. He's got more slaves than trustees. And in fact, an honest accounting would say that he has more slaves than actual students. The largest population of people on early Dartmouth campus are slaves. Well, Wheelock actually, is in one episode, calls the sheriff onto the campus for the purpose of, basically having beaten one of his slaves, who he thinks is actually stepped beyond the line of good behavior. Here in Boston, one of the presidents of Harvard, Benjamin Wadsworth, had earlier given a sermon while he was a minister in Boston before he took the presidency about the necessity of beating slaves, the biblical imperative to actually beat servants to make sure that they behaved. And he quoted scripture as he instructed his audience that it was their moral duty to inflict physical punishment on the slaves in order to keep them in line. Wadsworth actually had a slave with him while he was the president of Harvard, Titus Wadsworth, who lived right on the Harvard campus in the president's house. And so, the violence that attends slavery also attends slavery in the North, but one can actually extend that. The academy rises by feeding upon the rise of the Atlantic slave trade and African slavery in the Americas. It's a source of both funding of students, of much of the wealth of the colonial college, but also when we begin to build science programs and medical programs, those faculties use the bodies of enslaved people and other marginalized people like Native Americans and sometimes the Irish for instructional purposes. And so at Dartmouth, Eliezer Wheelock, the founder, his personal physician, takes the body of an enslaved black man who just passed and removes the entire skin from it. He then boils this man, Cato. He boils his body in a large kettle to separate the bones. He wires the bones into a skeleton for instructional purposes, and then he takes the skin of Cato, the entire skin of the man, to the tanner, the leather tanner who serves the college, and has it tanned so that he can use it to wrap his medical instrument case. Mm. So his bag is actually wrapped in the skin of a Negro. We also know that at Harvard College in 1763, there's a fire in Harvard Hall which destroys, a fire burns Harvard Hall, and in the list of the things that were lost in the fire is included the jaw of a famous Indian chief. I believe that's Metacomet, King Philip, who the English call King Philip.
Yeah.
The famous King Philip of King Philip's War in 1675, but also the entire hide of a Negro, which had been tanned like leather for instructional purposes. And so, yeah, the rise of the sciences in the 18th century, the rise of medicine and the sciences in the 18th century feeds upon the bodies of living and enslaved people, living and dead enslaved people.
Yeah.
And they become the material for the rise of the sciences.
So on this thing about the importance then of universities coming out with these scholars and training these scholars who then have these theories that fundamentally justify slavery by the inferiority of people of African descent. So tell us a little about that, because that was really an important role, and perhaps even some of the purpose that they were so anxious to get the colleges going in the first place.
There was a perception that I had, actually, I think a lot of historians have, of the rise of racial science largely taking place in Europe and then expanding outward from there and being projected outward from there. And so in part, one of the things I had done was I went to some of the key centers for science instruction in the colonial world in the 18th century. And I looked at, I was researching the lecture notes of the professors, in part because I wanted to figure out how students in the 18th century learned race and what they were learning. And one of the things I noticed was actually that there was a lot less about race in many of these lectures than I thought there would be. But there was something else that was quite striking, which was the rise of a population of American-born colonial students in Europe. You know, by the 18th century, there are enough Virginians at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland to form a Virginia Club. And the students from the American colonies, from New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Barbados, are actually flooding into the best schools in Europe to study medicine and science. There's a race, actually, by the early 1760s. Between the New Yorkers and the Philadelphians to finish the medical program in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and then to get back to establish the first medical school in the colonies. The Philadelphians win, and the first medical college will be at the University of Pennsylvania, and it will begin in part when the colonial government transfers to the new medical faculty the body of a Negro, so that they can actually show the intellectual importance and power of dissection and anatomy through a public dissection. The next one will be established at King's College, which is now Columbia University in Manhattan. And again, you know, it's access to the bodies of enslaved people. But the other thing that I realized as I was sort of tracing the journeys of these students is that when young Americans actually arrived in Europe at these centers for the study of science, they often got transformed on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean into experts on race, because they actually were coming from places, many of them are from slaveholding families, from plantations families in Virginia, the Carolinas, and the West Indies, but the Northerners are also often from slaveholding families in places like New Jersey and New York. Many of them have intimate relationships with Africans and Native Americans, and they emerge in Europe as sort of experts on race, and particularly on the populations of people in the Americas. They're producing dissertations at times, for instance, on the course of disease among Native Americans. They're giving lectures on the frequency of certain kinds of conditions and diseases, and the impact of certain kinds of diseases on Native Americans and Africans, the difference between different populations of people and their resistance to diseases. They emerge as experts, and then when they get back to the Americas, a lot of that expertise, or at least that claim to expertise, becomes central to the project of establishing these new medical schools and science faculties. So that by the, you know, what the chapter that you talk about on the bodily and mental inferiority of the Negro is the title of the chapter. It looks at an early 19th century case, an 1808 case in New York City, in which the court calls upon the leading medical experts for testimony in what's a paternity case. And what's that question is the father of a child who's now being sought, the father's being sought out under a new York state law. And there's a possibility that it's Alexander Winslow, a black man, or an unnamed white man. And the court can't determine the paternity, and so what they do is they turn to a series of experts. They draw the experts from these new colleges, from the, you know, what's now Columbia, what's Columbia College's medical school, the College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York, the Rutgers University Medical School, which was then Queens College, and the College of Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania Medical School. And these experts actually now display the power of racial science as they attempt to determine the paternity of this child. But it's a remarkable moment for understanding both how fully, how quickly, and how decisively racial science emerges in the Americas and achieves a kind of legitimacy in the intellectual cultures of the Americas, and how important Americans are to that process.
Yeah, and very important in the post-slavery era with, you know, Jim Crow, and even today there's some of that still bantering around.
There is.
Yeah.
At every elite university in the United States, there's some version of this science.
Yeah,
still being produced. Yeah,
and I'm speaking with Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder, and he has a brand new book out entitled "Ebony and Ivy: Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities." I did want to you to say a bit too about the American Colonization Society.
The book ends. The honest ending of the book is in the 1830s. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an epilogue that takes us a bit further up to the Civil War. But really, in fact, the primary part of the book, the real central arguments of the book, end in the 1830s. And there's a reason for that. The reason was that the 1830s is a period when I think the modern American university emerges. The university that we recognize today, the college that we recognize today, emerges roughly in the 1830s. The 1830s are the period when colleges throw off the final vestiges of their early relationship to churches. And we didn't talk about this, but you know, the earliest of the colleges, the colonial colleges, are denominational schools. So, you know, the College of Rhode Island, which is now Brown, is a Baptist college. The College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, is a Presbyterian college. Columbia is Anglican. And so the colleges are actually denominational schools. They throw off the final vestiges of their connection to the church by the 1830s. And they enter into a new moment in which they can occupy the public sphere independently, where they become important institutions in the public affairs of the United States, no longer subordinate to the church. And part of the path to that new political presence, to that new public presence and public role, is actually their expertise, over the claimed expertise, over questions like race and the appropriate makeup of the citizenry of the United States. And I look at this in a number of ways, and one of them is the overrepresentation of academics in movements like the colonizationist movement. The American Colonization Society is founded in 1817 with the purpose of removing free black people from the United States to someplace outside the United States. In 1822, the Colonization Society establishes the Liberia colony on the African coast. And the Reverend Ralph Randolph Gurley, who's the principal agent of the society, invents the name Liberia for that colony. But the goal of the Colonization Society to remove the free black population runs parallel with a series of removal campaigns that actually define a whole generation of American history, really a good 30-year period of American history. One has to understand colonization in dialogue with the campaign to remove for Indian removal, the 1830 Indian Removal Act, and the campaign to remove Native American nations from the southeastern seaboard states, sort of forced migration west of the Mississippi River, and movements like the Society for the Amelioration of the Condition of the Jews in New York, which is seeking to convert the Jewish population to Christianity, or to fund their removal to some place outside the United States. When you put these movements together and you think about how attracted so many Americans were, we're talking about, you know, millions of people who were attracted to movements to racially and religiously homogenize the United States and create an all-white, all-Christian nation. One of the things that's stunning about this is that the logic beneath these movements was largely crafted on campus. It was the emergence of a kind of racial science and a definition of race that made the inclusion of other people unacceptable, because it made permanent the differences between human beings, immutable, unchangeable, and fixed. And it provided a rationale for projecting a future of the American nation in which progress almost seemed to require racial homogeneity or a certain kind of ethnic cleansing in which people were simply removed from the society. Academics are, in fact, completely overrepresented in the American Colonization Society. About probably three-quarters of the campuses in the United States by the 1830s are actually have relationships to the American Colonization Society. At the height of its power, the president of the American Colonization Society is the former president of the United States, James Madison. His vice president is the president of Yale, the Reverend Jeremiah Day. And Reverend Day's status within the Colonization Society doesn't rest upon his status as a minister, which in the 18th century would have been, in fact, the reason why he entered into public affairs. A college president would enter into public affairs. Like during the American Revolution, a lot of college presidents are actually actively engaged in the American cause. But typically, they're actually standing on their credentials as ministers, as representatives of church populations. By the 19th century, when Day is standing at the top of the American Colonization Society, he's standing on his status as an academic, as someone who has a claim to secular expertise and who has definitions of the future of the nation and a vision of the future of the nation, which is informed by an expertise that has been generated on campus and uses the unshakable claims of science as its foundation.
Well, Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder, professor of American history at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also has taught at Williams College and Dartmouth College, has a brand new book out now, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's University, Ebony and Ivy. Sadly, we're out of time. I just can't believe it. Thank you for joining us.
It did go quickly.
We are out of time. I'd like to thank our guest, Professor Craig S. Wilder. Today's show was produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, Chris McComb, Sherelle Withers, our engineer, and, of course, assistant producer, Kevin Walker. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, fighting the U.S. corporate extractors on indigenous land in prose and poetry. Also, an update on the continuing violent, illegal Israeli seizure of Palestinian land in East Jerusalem and on the West Bank, and the racist dual standard at the U.S.-Mexico border. Ukrainians, welcome. Haitians, whipped, shackled, and deported. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.